What's it like to have a lot of money?
It gives you a degree of freedom. And it also gives you a degree of power.
Little children have fantasies. The child who is skinny and weak delights in dreaming that with the snap of a finger, he can become a Stallone, or minus the German accent, a Schwarzenegger. The kid who rarely leaves home and doesn't travel wishes he could be a pilot or an astronaut. But what is one to make of a child who believes he was God?
I just told you who I thought I was, a god.
Those were the thoughts of young George Soros, growing up in upper middle class surroundings in 1930s Budapest. An otherwise normal child who had many friends, loved sports, and behaved much like other children his age, just a bit more megalomaniacal. It would be easy to explain such thoughts as daydreams of a small child if George Soros had shown some signs that he had outgrown these messianic beliefs as an adult. Yet, as an adult, he offered no sign, no dismissive gesture, no footnote signifying that he no longer clung to such wild convictions.
I did have fantasies of saving the world, so I had that in the sort of what I called messianic fantasies, which I think most adolescents have. I've been somewhat more successful of actually acting out those fantasies.
And indeed, as Soros grows up, his reality comes dangerously close enough to his fantasy of thinking himself God. There are few personalities out there that are more polarizing than Soros. When I asked you for video suggestions, his name kept coming up. And once we started digging into Soros, we made fascinating learnings we didn't expect.
I am there to make money. I cannot and do not look at the social consequences of what I do.
This is the based biography of George Soros, his younger years as an extremely ambitious gigachad.
This man is a carnivore of the first order.
His masterful rise to the top of the global financial elite.
George Soros is the world's most famous investor and speculator. It was his fund that earned in excess of $1 billion when it bet against the British pound in 1992.
And the conspiracy theories tied to his Sigma persona.
One of your money managers told us George really does think he's a god.
George Soros is born Soroszk in Budapest in 1930 to a wealthy Jewish family. Similar to right honorable gigachads like Schwarzman, Ekman or Kravis, Soros is born into a Jewish family. In 1936, Soros' family changes their name from the German Jewish Schwarz to Soros, as protective camouflage in an increasingly anti-Semitic Hungary. In Hungarian, Soros means next in line or designated successor. In Esperanto, it means will soar. George's father likes the new name because it is a palindrome and because of its meaning. His father, Tivadar, is a lawyer who has served in the Austro-Hungarian army during World War I, was captured, and spent 3 years in Russia, from the revolution to the beginning of the Civil War.
He went through a formative experience in the Russian Revolution. He lived through the Russian Revolution in Siberia. And that, you know, living in that chaos and turmoil shaped him.
These formative experiences will be taught by a monster that was going to endanger Soros' grandiose ambitions.
Herr Roosevelt verlangt endlich die Bereitwilligkeit, ihm die Zusicherung zu geben, dass die deutschen Streitkräfte das Staatsgebiet folgender unabhängiger Nationen nicht angreifen, und nennt Finnland, Lettland, Litauen, Estland, Norwegen, Schweden, Dänemark, Niederlande, Belgien, Großbritannien, Irland, Frankreich, Portugal, Spanien, die Schweiz, Liechtenstein, Luxemburg, Polen, Ungarn, Rumänien, Jugoslawien, Russland, Bulgarien, Türkei, Irak, Arabien, Syrien, Palästina, Ägypten.
When World War II begins in September 1939, George is 9 years old. First, his life hardly changes because the Nazis pose no threat to Hungary at that time. For now, life for the residents of Budapest remains routine. As the war progresses, however, the threat of a German invasion of Hungary looms larger. George Soros and the rest of the Hungarian Jewish community are about to experience the horrors of the war. Soros is 13 years old in March 1944 when Nazi Germany occupies Hungary. The Nazis don't allow Jewish children to attend school, and Soros and the other school children are made to report to the Judenrat, or Jewish Council, which has been established during the occupation. Soros' family is going to bend reality in order to ensure survival.
There are times when the normal rules don't apply.
Later that year, at age 14, he takes on a fake identity.
He arranged for all of us false papers. I was adopted by an official of the Minister of Agriculture, whose job was to take over Jewish properties. So
hiding is essential. In all, George and his family have access to 11 hiding places. Often they spend weeks in the attics or basements of friends, never knowing whether they will suddenly have to vacate the spot.
You watched lots of people get shipped off to the death camps.
Right. I was 14 years old, and I would say that that's when my character was made. That one should think ahead, one should understand and anticipate events.
If the 14-year-old George experiences fear at these times, he never admits it later. George finds the whole experience of the war during 1944 thrilling, and he describes it later as the happiest year of his life. For it has given him the opportunity to witness his father's heroism. And there is something else, a sense of invincibility, oblivious to danger and immune to fear. A first taste of that sweet silverback mindset he will develop later. His father, Tivadar, teaches George valuable lessons about the art of survival. 1. It is all right to take risks. Having risked his life daily during the latter part of World War II, Tivadar comes to believe that most other risks are worth taking. 2. When taking risks, don't bet the ranch. Never risk everything. That would be foolish, impractical, and unnecessary. In the fall of 1947, at the age of 17, Soros feels it is time to leave Hungary and head for the West. His first stop is Bern, Switzerland. But what is an ambitious nascent silverback to do in Bern except for eat Swiss cheese and chocolate? So soon he moves on to London, a place that sounds more attractive. Thanks to his father, George has enough money for the journey. But once there, he will be largely left to his own resources. Although England is supposed to provide George Soros with a happier life, he finds himself with too little money and companionship to enjoy what the city has to offer. In that sense, poor and without friends, he resembles many Right Honorable Andrew Tate fans. This is one of the most difficult episodes of his life. All that the 18-year-old can do is go from odd job to odd job, hoping that his luck will eventually turn. Sometimes, when his cash flow is nearly zero, George sustains himself by eating leftover profiteroles. Years later, he even remembers envying a cat because it was eating sardines while he was not. But in 1949, his luck finally turns. Soros is accepted as a student at the London School of Economics. LSE is one of England's great educational institutions, an ideal place to study, whether one wants a career or an academic life. The school attracts an international student body and is generally regarded as leaning towards socialism. Luckily, today it is one of the target recruiting pools for capitalist empires such as Goldman Sachs or BCG.
When I was 17, I became a student in London. My primary interest was to gain a better understanding of the strange world into which I had been born. But I have to confess, I also harbored some fantasies of becoming an important philosopher.
Other than today's useless generation that wants to become TikTok influencers, George wants practical training in economics and at the same time is eager to study philosophical lessons. Although Soros completes the coursework for his undergraduate degree in just 2 years, he decides to hang around LSE for another year until he can obtain his degree in the spring of 1953. During that time, Soros develops a mentorship relationship with Karl Popper, a famous Austrian-British philosopher.
I do have a great respect for Popper. I mean, Popper's ambition, in relation to science at least, was to discriminate between the sort of science and what he calls pseudoscience.
Philosophy, whether the thoughts of Karl Popper or anyone else, was not supposed to be a roadmap for making money in the real world. Yet, for George Soros, philosophy and mentor Karl Popper will serve just that purpose.
And then I was reading Popper, who made it clear that perfect knowledge is unattainable. You can't validate the theories, you can only falsify them. And I sided with Popper.
In time, he will go from the abstract to the practical, and from those theories, he will spin new theories about the way the financial markets function. From the London School of Economics, Soros graduates as a Bachelor of Science in Philosophy in 1951 and a Master of Science in Philosophy in 1954. The intellectual stimulation at the LSE helps Soros overcome some of his loneliness. He is still poor, but he seems to be enjoying himself more. He can easily imagine himself remaining at LSE and becoming an academic, perhaps even a philosopher like Karl Popper. But however much Soros wanted to teach, it is clear to him that he needs to make a living. And he needs to do it fast. He is 22 years old, and while he longs to make some great contribution to human knowledge, he has to eat. Upon graduation, he senses there is good money to be made in investing. Needing a foot in the door of a London investment bank, he drafts a letter to all the investment banks in the city. A bank called Singer and Friedlander offers him a job as a trainee. It is basically an elite boutique, as you would call it today. He accepts happily. He becomes a trader, specializing in gold stock arbitrage, trying to take advantage of price discrepancies in the different markets. Trying, because apparently he was not really a high performer at his first job. That's why in 1956, the young investment banker believes that it is time to move on to New York City.
Yes, this is New York, the world's largest, most exciting city, seen from the world's tallest building.
I chose the West. Because I sought for freedom. But to be frank, I came to America to make money.
In leaving for New York, George Soros acknowledges to himself once and for all that he is serious about a career in finance. The dream of becoming a philosopher will have to remain a dream. Like Kevin John moving to Shanghai in China, moving to New York automatically gives George a competitive advantage over his colleagues. He has acquired important knowledge of European financial markets, while experts on that subject are a dime and a dozen in London. The people on Wall Street have little experience or understanding of European markets. Actually, it is quite similar to today.
We are the country of Asia.
That's a continent, and that's Russia.
Through a work contact, Soros scores a job at F.M. Meyer as an arbitrageur. Though arbitrage will grow into one of the hottest financial games of the 1980s, 3 decades earlier it's pretty dull. Traders like George Soros buy and sell the same securities in different markets, and they hope to exploit small price discrepancies that they find through meticulous research. In time, Soros becomes an analyst offering advice to American financial organizations about European securities. As he has expected, few on Wall Street have any great instinct for investment trends in Europe. Europe is boring, just like today.
Also guten Tag und guten Nachmittag, guten Abend, guten Morgen.
It is long before the current era of global trading, long before American investors begin to sense that there is money to be made on the other side of the pond. A perfect opportunity for young Soros. In 1959, Soros moves upmarket to Wertheim & Co., an investment bank that will have some really catchy and cool advertisements in the 1970s. Here, Soros continues to devote himself to foreign securities arbitrage and the occasional client interested in European stocks. And like any good yuppie that wants to climb the career ladder, Soros keeps moving. In 1963, he moves again to Arnold Bleichroeder, another player in the securities market. It is the leading American house trading in foreign securities, so it is a natural home for Soros. Hired as an analyst, so-called chimps in banking jargon, Soros works primarily with foreign securities. With his network of contacts in Europe and his ability to speak a number of European languages, including French and German, Soros is the natural person to venture into this realm. And Soros continues climbing the ranks of the finance jungle. In 1967, he is made head of investment research. His job is to find interesting investment opportunities in undervalued European stocks for wealthy families that are looking to grow their wealth. He is doing a good job. His self-confidence grows, and Soros begins thinking about starting his own investment fund. From the time he was a student in London in the early 1950s, George Soros has been interested in the way the world functions. But he doesn't just want to debate the current thing like today's woke wannabe activists. He wants to make a sizable contribution to knowledge, a real difference. And now, entangled in financial market thoughts, he will come up with a theory that changes everything. And one word is key to his thinking: perceptions. Many people ask the same questions. What is life all about? Why am I here?
Why are you gay?
And how do things like the universe, the brain, humankind work? Dwelling on these questions for a moment or two, people then get on with their lives, with the practical issues of raising families, making a living, or binge-watching Kevin John videos. Philosophers, however, make such questions their life study, and George Soros longs to be a philosopher. However, as young Soros figures out almost from the very start, the task of unraveling the mysteries of life is nearly an impossible one. For one simple reason: to even begin to study who we are or what we are, we need to look at ourselves objectively. The trouble is that we cannot. This is a dramatic revelation for George Soros and forms his first of two major propositions.
I can state the core idea in two relatively simple propositions. One is that the situation that has thinking participants, the participants' view of the world, is always partial and distorted. That's the principle of fallibility.
And this principle of fallibility has profound consequences on his thinking. While classical economics teach the concept of a perfect equilibrium and make assumptions as if perfect competition and perfect knowledge are attainable, Soros believes he knows better.
My interpretation of financial markets directly contradicts the efficient market hypothesis.
He says any theory that assumes perfect knowledge is attainable is flawed, and this is the basis for his second and most known proposition.
The other is that these distorted views can influence the situation to which they relate, because false views lead to inappropriate actions. That's the principle of reflexivity.
And so let's disentangle this for a second. The major insight Soros brings to the table is that market distortion works in both directions. Not only do market participants operate with a bias, think a typical Robin Hood trader, but their bias can also influence the course of events. Think pumping GameStop to the moon. This may create the impression that markets anticipate future developments accurately, but in fact, it is not present expectations that correspond to future events, but future events that are shaped by present expectations. And this, ladies and gentle gorillas, is what Soros calls reflexivity. Ah, reflexivity. You just learned about George Soros' most important theory. Congrats, you can now name drop reflexivity and impress other people in finance. But we are not done yet. Stick with us for one more minute to understand how to make massive amounts of money. A second key to Soros' theory is grasping the role played by misconceptions in shaping events. Misconceptions, or divergences between a participant's thinking and the actual state of affairs, are always there. Sometimes the divergence is reasonably small and can correct itself. He calls this situation near equilibrium. But sometimes the divergence is large and not self-correcting. This situation he terms far from equilibrium. If all of that is too complicated, here's a quote even sub 85 IQ viewers should be able to process. I am fascinated by chaos. That's really how I make my money. All of these thoughts George Soros captures in a book called The Alchemy of Finance, which will eventually help make him a much more widely recognized figure in the business community than ever before. In the late 1960s, George Soros enters the big leagues of finance. Seeking more of a leadership role within the firm, Soros manages to persuade his bosses at Arnold S. Bleichröder to set up a pair of offshore funds and to let him oversee them. The first, called the First Eagle Fund, starts in 1967. It is known in Wall Street jargon as a long fund. They take investment positions hoping for bullish markets. The second, a hedge fund, is the Double Eagle Fund and starts in 1969. The fund is structured in such a way that Soros can use stocks and bonds as collateral in order to buy any number of financial instruments, including stocks, bonds, and currencies. He starts the fund with his own money, a mere $250,000, but soon $6 million pour in from a number of wealthy Europeans whom Soros knows.
This
is the beginning of Soros' fortune. In the late 1960s, hedge funds were little known. In 1957, a random guy called Warren Buffett had started his own hedge fund. But when Soros sets out in 1969, few know what such funds do. That will, of course, change by the 1990s. Hedge funds will produce some iconic and some comical figures.
Buy 5 HMTT at an 8. See what happens. I want an offering on 1,000. I want an offering on 1,000. I want an offering on 1,000. Yes, double down, double down.
And George Soros will become head of the greatest hedge funds of them all. But he's not only among the first in the hedge fund field, where the profits are potentially sky high. He's also the first to use controversial financial instruments called derivatives that are today closely associated with the hedge fund crowd. The first industry Soros watches closely for the Double Eagle Fund are real estate investment trusts. In 1969, Soros establishes a solid reputation by pointing out in a widely circulated memo the advantages of investing in a new vehicle called the Real Estate Investment Trust, or REIT.
So what is a REIT exactly? Well, the REIT, or Real Estate Investment Trust, was created by US Congress in 1960 as a legal entity in order to make investments in income-producing real estate more accessible to the public.
Sensing a boom-bust sequence, he likens the REIT cycle to a three-act play, similar to AMC or GameStop, predicting that REITs will experience a boom, but then go too far and eventually collapse. He buys shares and wins. Soros is right and earns a handsome profit. When, as he forecasts, the REITs become overblown in 1974, Soros goes short, making another quick $1 million. $1 million.
I gotta pump those numbers up. Those are rookie numbers in this racket.
A small first win, but this early exercise in testing his marketplace theories encourages Soros immensely. It is time to go bigger. And the finance gods sent him a sign on what to do next. They send it in the form of regulations. These new regulations prohibit Soros to get a percentage of the profits from their stock trades. Arnold and S. Bleichröder does not want him to leave, but Soros has an itch to become independent and to keep making massive amounts of money. And in 1971, another event takes place that ironically provides massive opportunities for currency speculators.
The strength of a nation's currency is based on the strength of that nation's economy.
and the American economy is by far the strongest in the world. Accordingly, I have directed the Secretary of the Treasury to take the action necessary to defend the dollar against the speculators. I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets.
Soros decides to take the plunge. In 1973, he departs with his colleague Rogers, and together they establish Soros Fund in New York City. Their former investors get the choice to transfer their money to this new fund or keep their money with Arnhold. And this will be the beginning of a legendary run, the returns of which might only be rivaled by Wall Street Bets legends such as R. Anal Farmer or R. Deep Fucking Value. From December 31, 1969 until December 31, 1980, the Soros Fund gains 3,365%. Compare that with the Standard & Poor's Composite Index, which advances in that same period only 47%. And compare that with your own portfolio, which would have lost 3% in that time frame. By the end of 1980, the fund is worth $381 million. And Soros keeps on winning. He is gifted at spotting undervalued sectors in the US markets and overseas. When US stocks are getting creamed in the middle 1970s, he buys Japanese, Canadian, French, and Dutch stocks, with the Japanese representing about a quarter of the entire portfolio. And more, he notices the rapid increase in the US imports of foreign oil and buys oil field services and drilling stocks before the Arab oil embargo in 1973.
Good evening. The Middle East war produced developments all over the world today. The oil producing countries of the Arab world decided to use their oil as a political weapon. They will reduce oil production by 5% a month until the Israelis withdraw from occupied territories.
Everything he does seems to be contrarian, but he makes money, and he makes first enemies too. His bets on falling currencies or nations are sometimes ruthless, but inevitable, as he says.
I don't feel guilty because I'm engaged in an amoral activity which is not meant to have anything to do with guilt.
Many investors believe the financial world to be rational, convinced that stock prices have a built-in logic. Discern that logic and you could become rich. Soros has none of that. He thinks the world is unstable, chaotic. His approach to financial markets is something that has never been seen before. He says that trying to understand the financial markets, as if their movements are part of some gigantic mathematical formula, will never work. Not mathematics govern the financial markets. Psychology does. More precisely, the herd instinct. Figure out when and how the herd is going to get behind a certain stock or currency or commodity, and you can make massive amounts of money. That becomes Soros' theory in a nutshell, and Wall Street Bets too. By 1975, George Soros is beginning to be noticed within the Wall Street community. More precisely, his talent for making money is attracting attention. In the 2 years prior, in 1973 and 1974, the worst years of the decade for the Dow, Soros reported gains of 8.4% and 17.5%. Few have any doubts that he is destined for greatness. But in 1977, his marriage begins to fall apart. According to Soros, "I identified with my fund. It lived off me and I lived with it, slept with it. It was my mistress. It was a fear of losing and the distress of being wrong that I was trying to avoid. It was a miserable way to live." A year later, in 1978, he separates from his wife. On the very day of his separation, he runs into a 22-year-old woman named Susan Weber, whom he has met sometime before at a dinner party. In an absolute giga chat move, he says, "I just got separated from my wife today. Would you like to have lunch?" He and Susan Weber will get married 5 years later in Southampton, Long Island. According to a newspaper report, Soros shows up late for the wedding because he has been playing tennis. Other articles in the media report an embarrassing moment at the wedding ceremony, one that Soros might have avoided had he taken the time to rehearse the ceremony. When the minister asks Soros if he's willing to give all his worldly goods to his new wife, Soros turns white. One of Soros' sons pretends to cut his throat, apparently trying to suggest to his father, perhaps half-jokingly, "There goes your fortune." Soros quickly looks behind him at his personal attorney, William Zabel, as if to say, "Would I really be bound to give everything to Susan?" Zabel saves the day by indicating to Soros that no harm will be done by his answering. Just to be on the safe side, Soros mumbles in Hungarian, "Subject to my prior agreements with my heirs." With that, the ceremony carries on. Once again, Soros is starting to feel godlike, but he is soon going to experience his toughest challenge yet. In 1980, his new fund reports a stunning 102.6% return, and its assets under management rise to $381 million. Soon afterward, institutional investor puts him on the cover as the world's greatest investor. He is described as mysterious, remote, aloof, tricky but not dishonest, and very hard to follow in the markets or in his explanation of his theories of the markets. At this point, Soros is the world's first global investing superstar. But Soros is about to fall into a hole. He keeps up a frenetic pace out of a conviction that he is someone special, someone endowed with a special purpose in life. This is a man, let us remember, who believed as a child he was God. But after 12 incredible years of fighting his way to the top, he realizes that life as an investor is not enough to satisfy him.
I mean, I had one particular experience when I was under tremendous strain, and I thought I was going to have a heart attack. And I thought, what a shame to die, making money.
Soros' identity crisis affects his business. He is increasingly quick to change his mind when an investment appears to be turning sour. He keeps positions too long, and he surrounds himself with the wrong people. The following year, 1981, is Soros' worst. The fund loses 23%. His European investors have made so much money with him in the past, but it doesn't matter. A third of them withdraw their funds. Soros is shocked and hurt. It seems only natural that George Soros will talk of quitting. He thinks long and hard about what to do. The time seems ripe to get started on the book he has long wanted to write. Is this the end of his investing career? Not yet. He still had to attempt his most famous trade yet, the one that broke the Bank of England. And as we know, his image as a conspiracy theory magnet still needs to develop too. Soros' number one motto is, if you are going to bet, you must bet big. This belief he puts into practice in November 1985, just before the famous Plaza Hotel agreement.
In the early 80s, the US dollar floated high against the Japanese yen and German Deutschmark, buoyed by the Reagan-era combination of tight money and a high budget deficit. That was good news for Japan and Germany, because the high dollar meant a low yen and Deutschmark, and low prices for Japanese and German exports. More sales and more jobs.
That's when the finance ministers of the G7 countries meet in New York to do something about the soaring dollar. Soros is convinced that the dollar's high valuation relative to the yen and the mark cannot be justified on economic grounds. So in early September, he accumulates an $800 million position in the yen and the mark, $200 million more than the entire fund's value, a big bet. He settles in to wait for things to happen. On September 22nd, there is big news.
Their surprise decision, the Plaza Accord, an agreement to sell dollars on worldwide currency markets in an effort to send the dollar and American export prices down.
This result is exactly what Soros has foreseen.
The dollar had been dropping, and now it dropped faster, down a record 4.29% the day after the Plaza, down almost 55% a year later against the yen.
Soros makes 40 million overnight, and by October, when the yen is at 205, a total of about $150 million. In 1985, the fund is up 122%. In his diary entry of September 28, 1985, Soros calls the Plaza Accord coup the killing of a lifetime. But the real killing of a lifetime is right ahead. A legendary GigaChat move that will forever cement his name in the history books and spark conspiracy theories across the globe. In 1988, Soros begins to look for someone to whom he can hand over the daily operations of the fund. Finding that person and putting him at the helm marks one of the most important decisions George Soros will ever have to make. He finds a kindred spirit in baby gorilla Stanley Druckenmiller. They are going to develop a heartwarming mentor-mentee relationship, just like I do with my mentees and my premium community that are trying to take over the world eventually. If you want to build a side venture at some point, listen up. We have channels to get your CV or cover letter reviewed by industry experts, channels to find ideas and co-founders for side ventures that can be built online, cheat sheets on how to build passive income, a career master planning channel, a gorilla after hours hangout, and much more. And here's the thing, if you stay in the community for more than 3 months, you get my Side Venture Toolkit for free, the ultimate guide and community for starting a side venture. It gives you not only literally hundreds of inspirations on what side ventures you can build, but it also gives you detailed instructions how to build the side venture of your choice without needing to code. I guarantee that if you put in the work, this side venture toolkit will help you build a side venture that generates at least 1000 bucks a month. And that's not all, there's going to be some absolutely proper giveaways and freebies for everyone in the future. All links are in the description below. Join now and let's make megalomania cool again. Like Soros, Druckenmiller has attracted virtually no media attention in the early years of his career. He's an investment whiz, today we would call him an S-tier investor, but few know anything about him. He has graduated in economics at the University of Michigan, but has found the program overly quantitative and theoretical and boring. Druckenmiller began his career in 1977 as a stock analyst for the Pittsburgh National Bank. 2 years later, in 1980, he left the bank to begin his own money management firm. That's at age 28, if you are looking for an ambitious benchmark for your own career. Druckenmiller called his fund Duquesne Capital Management. 6 years later, in 1986, Druckenmiller was recruited by Dreyfus to become a fund manager, though he was permitted to continue managing his Duquesne fund. Druckenmiller's success with the strategic fund comes to George Soros' attention. Soros approaches Druckenmiller. However, Druckenmiller has heard all the stories about Soros, that George likes to fire people on a whim, that the turnover at Quantum is rapid. When he mentions to his friends in the investment community that he is considering going over to the Quantum fund, they advise him not to take the job. It's exactly like when you have a job offer from Apollo Global Management, where analysts regularly work 100 hours a week. In the end, you accept the challenge. In September 1988, Soros offers him the job, and Druckenmiller accepts it. Soros' replacement has been found. Now all Druckenmiller has to do is demonstrate that he is up to the job. What follows is a number of trades in the FX field, Deutsche Mark, Japanese Yen, and so on. Since Druckenmiller has taken over at Quantum, the fund has averaged 40% annual gains in net asset value, higher than Soros' record of 30% annual gains from 1969 to 1988. In 1989, the first full year under Druckenmiller's leadership, Quantum rose 31.6%. Druckenmiller proves that he's a worthy successor. And like a true GigaChad, Soros teaches Druckenmiller significant lessons. Most importantly, Soros tells him that it's not whether you're right or wrong that's important, but how much money you make when you're right and how much you lose when you're wrong. He learns this soon after he begins work at Quantum. He has been unenthusiastic about the dollar and takes a large short position against the German mark. The position begins to go in his favor, and he is quite pleased with himself. But Soros will have some interesting input for Druckenmiller.
I'll never forget, I walked into his office and told him the fund at the time was $7 billion, that I wanted to put a $7 billion position on long the Deutschmark and short the pound. I explained my reasoning to him, which I thought was very sound. He looked at me with like the most disgusted look, and I was getting angry just with the body language feedback I was getting. And he said, look, you only get an opportunity like this. This is a one-way bet, maybe 2-3 times in your career, and you're just not betting enough. We shouldn't put 100% of the fund in this trade. We should put 200% of the fund in the trade, because the most you can lose in it is 0.5%, and you can make 20% in it. So your risk reward is tremendous.
Guests, Druckenmiller doubles his position. When Soros sees an opportunity, he's ruthless in pursuing it.
I said, go for the jugular, go for the kill.
And so in the end, just as Soros has predicted, even more profits pour into Quantum. Finally, in September 1992, Soros makes the killing that fixes him in the public eye once and for all.
She'll melt down on Black Wednesday.
Watch out, excuse me.
5 years ago today, the government faced one of the biggest financial crises in history.
It was incredible. You can hear wave after wave of selling hitting the market.
It was a day when the Bank of England lost billions and speculators made fortunes.
It was in excess of $1 billion of profits.
MLR's 15%!
A day of disaster from which the government never recovered.
It was quite clear the government was not in charge of events.
I had no doubt we were in the middle of quite the biggest political crisis that I could remember.
In 1992, the pound is in deep trouble. The pound is then a part of the European Exchange Rate Mechanism, or ERM, in which the participating common market countries are obligated to maintain the value of their currencies within a narrow range of the others. If this becomes difficult to do, the struggling country is expected to act. Either raise interest rates if the currency is weak, or lower interest if the currency is strong. This ERM system works fairly well until the fall of the Berlin Wall and the reunification of East and West Germany. The Germans making trouble. As popular as reunification is, it is hard on economic agreements. The Germans immediately are faced with a gigantic bill for acquiring East Germany. This bill is for new investment, subsidies, welfare payments needed to bring East Germany's economy up to the standards of the West. Now pay attention, chimps. Spending all this money meant that Germany has to issue more government bonds, which pushes Deutsche Mark interest rates up. The higher these rates go, the stronger the Deutsche Mark currency becomes, and the weaker the other currencies in the ERM become in turn. And because the pound is the most important currency within the ERM, most speculators have their eyes fixed on the pound. They are only waiting for signs that the pound has to fall, and they get a sign.
In Frankfurt, the president of the Bundesbank gave an interview to a journalist. It only needed a hint that the pound might devalue to provoke an avalanche of selling.
The pound falls and is under enormous pressure from speculators. The ERM, however, requires that countries like Britain raise interest rates to protect the pound Deutsche Mark exchange rate. That is tough, though, because Britain is in a recession and has very high unemployment.
Banks, pension funds, international companies told their dealers to sell the pound. And then the speculators joined the fray.
And so the carnage begins. Currency traders assume that the British will rather pull out of the ERM than strangle their own economy. This would mean a massive revaluation of currencies with massive profit potential. Soros believes that too, and he will prove that he's every bit of a cold finance player as people assume.
But it was only after I was with George that I learned how much you should really press a bet. Your confidence level is extremely high. It was amazing to watch that man when we had something we really believed in.
Various traders take positions to take advantage of this unique situation. But what makes Soros unique is the enormous size of his positions.
Did you put $10 billion at risk or
yes.
not?
Yes.
Essentially, Soros borrows British government securities, then sells them and reinvests the cash in German securities. The genius thing about this setup? The trade offers asymmetric upside.
A high reward, low risk bet.
Right.
In other words, if it had gone wrong, we would have had the transaction cost of undoing it. Right. Whereas if we got it right, we made something like 15-20%.
For those of you watching that have no clue what's going on, here's the thing. The cost of carrying the position is the interest rate difference between the cost of borrowing the sterling and receiving interest on the Deutsche Mark.
If the strategy works and the British drop out of the ERM in order to lower their interest rates, the sterling DM rate will drop very sharply and the positions can be liquidated by reversing them. So buying the cheaper sterling to cover the sterling borrowed and selling the appreciated Deutsche Marks.
As the traders start to set up their positions, they begin to put pressure on both currencies, and their respective governments begin to intervene in the foreign exchange markets to ease the pressure.
Get some dollar mark calls going out.
I need some cable calls, so I've got a stop loss.
The Bank of England hoped it could make George Soros lose his gamble. It planned to sustain the pound's value by buying pounds at the official high ERM rate. Billions of pounds of public money were about to be thrown into the defense of the pound.
This is the ideal situation for a foreign speculator. When a big government is on one side of the market and you are on the other, and it looks like the speculators are winning.
Intended to show strength, the markets perceived the rate rise as weakness and reacted accordingly.
The more the speculator brethren keep pushing, the more the market loses confidence in the sterling. And the more intervention comes from the Bank of England, causing further FUD. It really seems like the situation is doomed at this point.
They call it Black Wednesday, the day that currency speculators broke the Bank of England. The bank and British taxpayers lost £6 billion.
The 16th September 1992 will be forever cemented in the history books as Black Wednesday. On the morning of that day, the pound reaches the lower limit of 2.773 Deutsche Mark set by the ERM. With support purchases in the billions, the Bank of England tries to keep the pound within the limit set by the ERM. But the purchases hardly have any effect anymore. Therefore, they take measures that have never been seen before. An interest rate increase gets announced from 10% to 12% by Finance Minister Norman Lamont.
Sir, what was the one thing that you remember from that day very vividly? Was there a specific time, a specific hour where you kind of realized what was happening?
Well, I think the most vivid memory I have is just when we put interest rates up from 10 to 12%. How it had absolutely zero effect. And I remember just looking at the computer and seeing an absolutely straight line. The currency hadn't moved at all. And I felt just like a surgeon looking at a heart graph of a patient and realized the patient was dead.
To revive the dead patient, a few hours later, a second interest rate increase gets announced.
MLR's 15%.
15%.
What?
15%.
The interest rate market, which was sitting 30 yards away, exploded in noise. We thought, we can't believe it, the Bank of England's raised interest rates again. That was a sign of weakness, not of strength.
At this point, it is too late. Everyone, including Soros, feels that. The pound falls further and further, and by early evening is trading well below the set lower limit. The Bank of England can only continue its support purchases as long as it still has foreign exchange reserves. The Bundesbank, on the other hand, participates in the support purchases only reluctantly. The Germans wonder whether all of this still makes economic sense, yeah? On the evening of 16th September, it is clear that the speculators have won against the central banks.
Suddenly the Bank of England wasn't supporting pounds. Instead of a load of noise coming out of the voice brokers and everything and around the dealing room, everyone just sat in stunned silence for about 2 seconds or 3 seconds, and all of a sudden it erupted and sterling just free fell. That sense of awe that the markets could take on a central bank and actually win, I couldn't believe it.
The pound is trading well below the lower limit set by the ERM, and the central banks have unsuccessfully burned billions trying to keep the pound within the set limits. In the evening, therefore, Finance Minister Norman Lamont appears before the press and announces what speculators have long expected. Britain will leave the ERM.
A unique day in London's financial markets ended with the Chancellor announcing that the pound was being suspended from the ERM. And that the second of two dramatic interest rate rises during the day was after all cancelled.
Today has been an extremely difficult and turbulent day. Massive speculative flows continue to disrupt the functioning of exchange rate mechanism. In the meantime, the government has concluded that Britain's best interests are served by suspending our membership of the exchange rate mechanism.
In addition, the second key interest rate hike to 15% is withdrawn. And the market does the rest. Within 5 weeks, the pound falls by almost 15% against the German mark and by 25% against the US dollar.
It's really a once in a decade. That's when he is George Soros. That's when he just says, you can't have enough of this.
Altogether, Soros makes a profit of about 1 billion US dollar on the sterling Deutsche Mark bet and another 1 billion on a variety of other European currency positions. All of this is earned within just 1 week. To most of the British citizenry, Soros acquires the status of a folk hero. In a typically English way, they say, good for him. If he made $1 billion out of the stupidity of our government, he must be a brilliant guy. But not everybody looks at Soros so mildly. After the size of Soros' positions becomes known, he is branded as the man who broke the Bank of England by The Economist. The reputation stays with him well into the late 1990s, when angry prime ministers lashing out at international speculators refer to Soros by name, even when he has no position at all.
In the last 2 years, you've been blamed for financial collapse of Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, Japan, and Russia.
Yeah, all of the above.
All of the above.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you that powerful?
No, I think there's a great misunderstanding.
Adding to his notoriety, Soros gets named the highest paid man on Wall Street. In 1992, he earned 650 million US dollar, over five times what he has earned in 1991, 1 year prior. No longer can Michael Milken, one of my favorite finance criminals, claim the record for the $550 million he has earned in 1987. At the end of the year, the Quantum Fund is the leading offshore fund, with total assets of 3.7 billion US dollar, up almost 70%. Someone who has invested 10,000 bucks in Quantum when it was founded in 1969 and has reinvested all dividends would by the end of 1992 had a sum of almost $13 million. Damn. In 1994, Soros' fund manages more than $11 billion, while, for example, Robertson, the famous Tiger Dad, manages only $6 billion. Soros' continued success attracts troubling allegations. Many people start denying that he has some kind of investment intuitions. Rather, they insist he is engaging in something more nefarious. The man has friends. Not exactly a crime, but he does have friends in high places. And obviously, they give him information that the average retail investor just does not have access to. But as we will discover, Soros' connections reach much deeper. So far, George Soros has wanted the people to stand up and take notice of him. Now, they are doing just that, but not with respect, with suspicion. And also politicians start turning on him. Soros' dazzling moves in early 1993, coupled with the news that he has earned $650 million, make many politicians skeptical. They remember all too well the 1980s and the way Michael Milken, Ivan Bosky, and the other stars of the takeover era have raked in millions of dollars. Could George Soros be just another finance charlatan? After 1992, Soros leaves most of the trading to Druckenmiller and goes on to a variety of extremely high-profile activities, including giving advice to public figures, writing articles critical of economic policy, and appearing on TV talk shows. But he isn't entirely out of the business. In the background, he is still pulling some strings. And the new direction he takes in his life will give him even more leverage while pulling those strings. Early in his business career, philanthropy was the farthest thing from George Soros' mind. But now, he's warming up to the idea of philanthropy. Maybe there's something in it for him.
I used to enjoy making money a lot, but it doesn't give me, or didn't give me, the kind of satisfaction that I have in giving it away.
As Soros searches for a place where he can be a man on a white horse, he realizes that the watershed event of his life has been his escape from the closed society that has taken hold in his native Hungary. Since leaving Hungary, he has tasted freedom, first in England, then in the United States. Why not try to give others in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union that same opportunity and pursue his own agenda in the meantime? Soros decides that he will use his financial muscle to promote open societies, places where people can be autonomous, where they can speak their minds and pursue their own objectives. By bankrolling efforts to undermine communism, George Soros is in effect financing revolt throughout Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. The revolution will be conducted not at the barricades, not in the streets, but in the minds of the citizenry. And eventually, it will lead to the birth of democracy in these countries. Like the Rothschilds, he will use his wealth to redraw Europe's political map. Soros senses that he needs a showcase. He chooses his home country.
I started negotiating with the Hungarian authorities about setting up a foundation in Hungary in 84.
The chances of setting up such an institution are no better than 50-50.
Though on the plus side for Soros is the Hungarian government's wish to burnish its image abroad in order to obtain Western credit and, of course, hard currency. But on the minus side, Soros confronts a communist state that has no experience whatsoever with outsiders running philanthropic foundations, let alone outsiders seeking to encourage an open society.
Even if the Hungarian regime agrees to Soros' plan to set up a foundation, it is not going to give him much of a free hand. Soros, for his part, insists on independence. In the end, he succeeds in setting up the foundation, and he does not stop there. In 1987, he begins efforts to do the same in the Soviet Union. In 1988, he moves into Poland, and in 1989, Czechoslovakia. But his philanthropic efforts are not always greeted with open arms. Case in point, Romania. With a population of 23.1 million, Romania has in its midst 2.4 million Hungarians. A Hungarian-born billionaire in Romania, preaching capitalism, economic reform, and an open society, that seems like a disguised way to turn Romania's Hungarian population against the government to some Romanians. Attacks on Soros begin soon after the foundation is launched. Soros is even accused in some newspapers of trying to sell Transylvania, where 1.8 million Hungarians live, to Hungary. This is the perfect breeding ground for conspiracy theories, whether based or unbased. And there's many more attacks on Soros in more recent times. Since 2012, the Hungarian Fidesz government has labeled George Soros as an enemy of the state due to his humanitarian and political involvement in the European refugee crisis. As the 2018 election period starts, the government introduces public posters with a photo of Soros to create hostility in the general public towards him, using statements such as "Soros wants millions of migrants to live in Hungary" and "Soros wants to dismantle the border fence." The government also prepares a three-part law plan called the Stop Soros Package, which includes various steps against NGOs doing volunteer work related to the refugee crisis. Nevertheless, by the spring of 1994, the Soros philanthropic empire has spread to include 89 offices in 26 countries. He has given away $500 million in the previous 2 years, and he has made commitments to give another $500 million.
Whatever his motivations, no one can accuse him of greed. He's backed away from the day-to-day operation of his businesses and is giving away his billions now with the same determination that he made them.
But are Soros' actions really just goodwill? Some Soros watchers believe that the sole purpose of Soros' philanthropy is to give him better access to information so that he can invest more prudently. One strange coincidence seems to be that conferences Soros hosts for his foundations in Europe are mostly attended by cabinet ministers who represent countries where he invests.
When we went with him to Ukraine, he was treated like a visiting head of state and was received by the president. Then he was received by the prime minister and finally the central bank.
20% in cash.
They even allowed him to look at the books and asked him for advice.
Another factor that helps develop conspiracy theories around George Soros and makes him look very secretive: Soros' clients are all outside the United States and very secretive. And so, for example, in the early and mid-1980s, Soros' press policy is to have none. He has no spokesperson, no press releases are issued. The goal is clear. And there's a good reason for that that can be observed at many hedge funds today. They generally take sizable positions, and the last thing you want is for anybody to know what you're doing. Why? Because people front run. If you want to buy something and everyone else finds out about it, they buy it ahead of you. It can heavily mess up trades. With his heart and mind focused on Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, George Soros feels less and less inclined to keep up with what's going on at the Quantum Fund, and he can afford the diversion. Soros is on his way to becoming one of the richest men in America. He wishes to spend as much of his time as possible promoting open societies in Europe and as little as possible worrying about making a buck. And in February 1997, Soros changes directions in a major way. In an article he published in The Atlantic Monthly, he suggests that "the main enemy of the open society, I believe, is no longer the communist, but the capitalist threat."
I'm not opposed to capitalism. I want to improve it to make it more viable.
One of Soros' key points: he is charging wealthy Western nations with not sharing their riches with poorer nations. By the end of 1999, Forbes has Soros 69 down for a net worth of $4 billion after more than a decade of very active philanthropy in Eastern Europe and elsewhere. In April 2000, Soros announces his and Druckenmiller's withdrawal from large-scale and aggressive hedge fund investing and says anyone continuing to invest in the group's funds should expect lower returns in the future. Our large macro bad days are over, he says, adding, "We are bringing an epoch to an end." For all ambitious nascent business silverbacks wondering how a kid from Hungary was able to become one of the wealthiest and most mysterious investors on planet Earth: first, there was his brain power. While others in the market were struggling to keep up with one stock, one industry group, one commodity, Soros was absorbed at any given time in complex scenarios related to global trading. He discerned trends and movements growing out of the public statements of world financial leaders and the decisions these leaders made. Then, the man had guts. How else to explain the dispassionate manner in which he bought and sold mind-boggling amounts during his trades? You have to have cojones of steel for that. Then there was the vaunted Soros self-confidence. When Soros believed he was right about an investment, nothing could stop him. No investment position was too large. Holding back was for wimps. The worst error in Soros' books was not being too bold, but too conservative. Why so little? And you call that a position? Are Wall Street jargon classics because of Soros. Finally, there was his instinct, the ability to know when to speculate heavily, when to pull out of an investment position, when in effect you were on the mark and when you were not. He used to say that he would get back ages if a position needed to be corrected. But how did Soros do it? How did Soros make so much money without playing dirty? Soros himself contributes to our suspicions by telling us, as he did repeatedly, that he has had an easier time making money than spending it. By being secretive, by offering us a book full of explanations about his investment secrets, yet being obtuse about it, by declaring that he had come up with a theory to explain the financial markets, then suggesting that it was not really a theory at all, for it didn't work in every instance. At times, it appears that Soros offers glimpses into his inner financial soul, so that we would be appeased and leave him alone. At other times, Soros sounds as if he genuinely wants us to understand what has made him so successful. However secretive, mysterious, obscure George Soros has been, one way or the other, he has allowed the public to see his Geiger counter at work, to marvel at the Soros successes. Watching Soros perform, people try to put their suspicions aside. They want to believe that Soros is no fluke, that he can be imitated, that they too can become money-making machines, causing others to dream of reaching his heights. That, when all is said and done, is Soros' ultimate power.